fala de uma história de um povo que nasceu no continente e foram escravos.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. In May of 2004, Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia was sentenced to 9 months in prison for refusing to return to Iraq. He was the first U.S. veteran of the Iraq War to publicly refuse further service. Since his release, he's been very active in the anti-war movement and just published his first book from the New Press called Road from Ar-Ramadi. Welcome, Camilo Mejia, to the show.
Thank you, Damon. It's a pleasure to be here, and my apologies about last week.
No problem. Well, we got the book, and everybody already in around the office is like, I want to read it. And I said, well, you know, the host of the show gets the first crack at it. So thanks for being here on the show. And I think, yeah, I got a bunch of questions for you, but I think one of the things that really want to understand or hear the kind of history of is, so you were in the Army for 9 years. Is that correct?
Well, I was in the Army for 9 years. The day of my conviction, actually, my court-martial's conviction, was my 9th-year anniversary in the Army. I'm on my 12th year now and counting.
So then what actually made you first sign up to be in the Army?
Well, you know, I had been traveling for a long time, ever really since I was born, when I first came here and lived in Spanish Harlem in New York City, and then traveling to Costa Rica, and then after the triumph of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, you know, we went back to Nicaragua, and then we traveled for a long time until finally coming back to the U.S. in 94 to settle here. And by the time I signed up for the military, I had lived in about 3 countries in a period of, you know, 2 to 3 years, so I was really lacking that sense of belonging, and I found myself out of prospects for the future because my financial aid to go to college was cut out. I had no friends. I had no, like I said, no sense of belonging, and you know, the military seemed like a way out of that situation. You know, it held the promise of an education and friendships and camaraderie and adventure and financial independence. So, you know, at the age of 19, I signed up for a 3.5-year contract with the active duty.
So then what was one of the main experiences that kind of you would attribute to the turning point from being kind of an infantry soldier to that wanted to get money for school, et cetera, into a conscientious objector?
Well, you know, obviously the war is responsible for that transformation. When I first deployed to Iraq, or before deploying to Iraq, you know, the rationale to invade Iraq was very flawed, and I was politically very much against the war. You know, one of the first things we told us when we arrived in Iraq was to put away our chemical protective gear, which, you know, they had also told us that we're going there to find stockpiles of chemical weapons, and then the first thing they tell us is to put away our protective chemical gear. But before going to the war, I had been politically against it, but it was my experience on the ground in Iraq that actually had that profound change, not just being against this particular war, but being against war in general and not wanting to have absolutely anything to do with the U.S. military anymore, at least in terms of invading other countries, which is what we seem to focus on. And the first mission that I had in Iraq was one to keep prisoners on sleep deprivation, and we did that by utilizing several techniques in psychological torture to keep people sleep deprived. We inflicted a great fear in the hearts of the prisoners, and this was the first mission that we had in Iraq. So obviously there begins to be a change within me because, you know, I'm no longer just politically against the war, you know, much the way somebody would be from just reading the newspapers or watching TV, because the opposition that I have is about something that I'm doing myself. You know, it's not just something I'm reading about, but torture, you know, abusing people, going into a whole different country to basically brutalize its population for all the wrong reasons. And, you know, it's not just something that I'm imagining, but something that I'm actually doing myself. So there begins to be a change from the moment we arrive in Iraq. but it is not something that you are able to digest right away. Basically, I did not go to Al-Asad, which is where we held these prisoners, and said, you know, I'm a conscientious objector. You know, it's just, it all happens progressively, and it's just really hard to realize what's happening inside of you because you're really afraid of your surroundings because you're a moving target every step of the way, and also because you don't want to be the one voice saying that what we're doing is wrong when everybody else is just complying. So you don't want to be perceived as a softy or a coward or a traitor, and so you just go along with everything that you're told. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's just really hard to point out a particular moment or situation that made me say, okay, I'm no longer an infantryman, I'm a conscientious objector. It didn't happen that way for me. You know, it was a very long and painful process.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I learned by reading the book was that basically people are not equipped to torture people, to shoot people, to go to war. And I think a lot of what I read in terms of the whole structure of the military, in terms of what you were talking about, the dropping and smoking, in terms of army discipline, is kind of designed to do that. So can you speak a little bit about what the goal of that in terms of your leadership in the military trying to get you to do? And then I guess the other thing is, and how did you resist that in your own leadership?
Well, yeah, obviously I had not really been the type of sergeant who would punish his soldiers, you know, and in the infantry particularly, in the larger military, but in the infantry particularly, which is a job in the military where you're supposed to be the toughest and the hardest. As a leader, you're expected to smoke your soldiers, you know, to punish them, to yell at them and to drop them, to make them do push-ups and sit-ups, and in some cases, you know, until they reach muscle failure. And I had never really been that type of leader in the military, but just before my deployment, you know, with all my opposition to the war, and in the beginning I did try to get out of the war, to not go by following, you know, legal channels. Obviously, my residency status was expiring because I'm not a U.S. citizen, and my residency was coming to, my green card was expiring. So I tried to use that to not go to the war without saying that I was opposed to it politically. And when those channels were closed to me, I was very frustrated because I had this secret, this dark secret inside that I was against the war, but I didn't feel like I could speak about it. So I took out my frustration on my soldiers, and I started smoking them and, you know, making them do push-ups and just being really abusive. But luckily, I realized what I was doing. I realized that it had nothing to do with discipline or any particular individual soldier, but more with my own frustration. So I made a decision not to be that way, not to be the type of leader that I had never really wanted to be. And, you know, I announced to people within my chain of command that I would no longer humiliate my soldiers, that I would no longer yell at them, and that I would no longer make them do any type of physical punishment. And that's where that comes from, basically. And in terms of how that works to brutalize Iraqis, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not a natural thing for people to either go halfway across the world to brutalize a country or to even do it to your own fellow men and women. You know, it's just something that has to be indoctrinated into your head, you know, from the moment you join the military. The first thing that they destroy is your sense of being an individual. You know, being an individual is actually looked down upon in the military. You know, when you're doing something that's not in agreement with what everybody else is doing, you know, the drill sergeants will tell you, you know, oh, you just want to be an individual. You don't want to get along with the program. So basically, taking your own initiative and being your own person is discouraged and punished, because it's not natural for people to brutalize other people, to humiliate, to abuse. These are very unnatural things, and the military has to really work hard on getting people to do the things that we do.
So this is Damon Azali Rojas on Voices from the Front Lines, speaking to the author of Road from Ar-Ramadi, who is Camilo Mejia. It's kind of a little bit closer to folks that I know in terms of one of my really close friends' brother. Just went through basic training, sign up for the army, as much like what you said, in terms of a way to kind of get out of the situation that he was in. And I guess the question that I would ask you in terms of the experience that you've had, you know, in the 139 degree heat of Iraq and whatnot, what would be some of the things that you would actually advise him to do to help maintain some sense of humanity in a very inhumane situation?
Well, I think it's different for everybody. You know, I cannot tell anybody out there to do what I did because we all have a different calling. You know, you may call that a conscience or you may call it God or you may call it something else, but we all have a sense of right and wrong. And it's different for every individual. You know, we have an individual named Joe Darby who basically exposed the abuses, you know, and the torture committed in the Abu Ghraib prison. You know, his calling was not to go AWOL and publicly speak against the war, but to basically, you know, do his job in the military and then make this information available so that it would get out and people could find out about what's happening. And, you know, for other people, like, for instance, Aaron Watada, you know, who's the first commission officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq, citing that the war is immoral, he did not go AWOL. He's not a conscientious objector. But, you know, his conscience is telling him that he could not participate in the Iraq war. So it comes down to, you know, the fundamental sense that we all have between right and wrong that separates right from wrong. I think that everybody in Iraq or here in the U.S., whether you're in the military or otherwise, we have that imaginary line that separates right from wrong. And it's sometimes it's really hard, particularly when it comes to a combat environment, to see that line, and once you do see it, to do what you know in your heart is the right thing to do. But I would tell people that when I saw that line in Iraq and I realized what I had to do, and I didn't because I was afraid that the leadership would go after me, I was not free. You know, I was a prisoner of you know, my fear. And when I decided to refused to go back to Iraq, and when I decided to go public with my opposition to the war, even though I knew that could mean jail time, and even as I went to jail and while I was in jail, I did not really feel like a prisoner. I felt free because I had, you know, done what my heart was telling me to do. So I would tell people to do their best to overcome their fear and do what they know to be the right thing, whether they're in Iraq or elsewhere. Because that's the only way that, you know, people can really achieve freedom, you know, by following their conscience. Mm-hmm.
So, Camilo, tell the listeners about what you wrote in your book in relation to the children throwing rocks and then the back and forth between Sergeant Rosado and Sergeant Williams.
Yeah, this was a mission that we had to patrol this neighborhood in Aramati, and obviously, there have been incidents before in which, well, at least there have been reports in which children had thrown grenades at soldiers. This makes it really hard to go out there and conduct a patrol in a place where you cannot even, you know, trust a child. So what happened that day was that our platoon leader decided to you know, come on the squad mission, which was my squad, to patrol this neighborhood, and a child threw a rock at him. So my platoon leader decided to make an example out of the child, and he ran after him, caught him, and was going to arrest him. So one of the sergeants in my team, my Bravo team leader, was not very happy about it. He was actually feeling quite sorry for the child, and he tried to stop my platoon leader, telling him that, you know, it was a long way from where we were to base, and that the child was barefoot, and that maybe, you know, we shouldn't take him. And then my platoon leader was unmoved, and he decided to take the child. Of course, I agreed with Rosado at the time. I didn't want to see the kid be arrested, but that day, you know, I was quiet. You know, I wasn't saying much, and that was something quite common there. You know, either Rosado or me were always complaining about something, but, you know, not all the time and hardly enough. But that was one of the days that I was keeping quiet and that Rosado was actually, you know, doing the right thing, and he was telling our platoon leader to not arrest the child, but, you know, he decided to take him anyway. So a man came out of this gate from, you know, that was probably to his home, and then he came to our platoon leader, and, you know, mostly through sign language they were able to communicate, and the man was basically pleading for the child not to be taken, and my platoon leader basically, to make a long story short, made the man deliver a public beating onto the child in order for everyone to see, because there was a pretty large crowd, you know, gathered around the scene. And, you know, he made the old man beat up the child before he let the child go. You know, he cut his restraints and he said, okay, you can have the kid now. And I remember at the time I felt like maybe that was something good because, you know, we had taught the kid a lesson and we had taught everyone there a lesson not to throw rocks because you never know when a soldier is going to think that that rock is actually a grenade and it's going to kill a kid just for throwing a rock. So at the time, part of me was saying that this is a good thing because we taught him a lesson. But, you know, thinking about it after the fact, it just didn't seem right anymore. I remember that one time somebody asked me about that experience, and I told the story for the first time even before I wrote it on the book, and I was crying. You know, I was crying as I told the story about the beating of the child. And I guess I realized that, you know, there's a lot of things that seem a certain way here, you know, when you have the ability to sit down and just think about things when you're not being attacked constantly. And the same experience is much different when you're in that type of situation, you know, where you're being threatened and, you know, every second of your life could be the last. But thinking about that episode in hindsight, you know, I felt terrible, you know, about not standing up for the child. But that's, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, that make an occupation such a horrible thing. You know, it's not just the killing, but how basically you brutalize the people. And it's not something as simple as something that you do to them. But, you know, the dynamic takes a life of its own, you know, and things like this end up happening where it's not just you beating the child or you killing people, but you making the Iraqis brutalize one another. You know, these are the type of things that an occupation will do to a people and to a land.
Yeah, I reading the book, you know, tears were coming to my eyes because it went from the young boy being scared about what was going to happen to him to the man basically hitting him and kicking him and all these different things. So then the boy stopped crying, and then the older man started crying. And I just, to me, just was so symbolic on so many levels of how so many people within that spectrum are dehumanized. I mean, the fact that this man had to do that because the alternative was, you know, he doesn't even know what.
Right, and I didn't even know what. I mean, God knows what happens to these people once we arrest them. You know, we arrest them and we detain them, and then after a while they get sent to a more permanent facility because obviously at that point we were an infantry unit, you know, doing combat missions. We were not really in charge of prisoners. So if we detained anybody, you know, we were not really aware of what happened to them afterward.
Right.
After we detained them.
So again, we're speaking with Carlos Mejia, the author of Road to Ar-Ramadi, who just came out with this book from the New Press. I guess it would be good to, you know, to leave us with. We know that there's still motion from the Bush administration to have more people serving in the military, not only for Iraq and Afghanistan, but all the other places that the U.S. presence is. And I guess with all of your experience, if you can just give, 30-second soundbite for all those teachers who are trying to support students for not being recruited, and for all the students who are in the malls and the high schools that are being recruited, what would you say to them to make them not sign up?
Well, you know, it's really difficult. You know, once somebody makes their mind up that they want to join the military, you're basically left with just chaining them to a tree and have the community feed them until the war ends. It's incredibly difficult once a young man or woman makes up their mind. I come from a revolutionary family. You know, both of my parents were involved in the Sandinista movement, and I still joined the U.S. military, which is amazing to most people who know my background. But I would tell people that there are options out there because a lot of times it comes to a lack of options when people join the military. In my case, it was a lack of sense of belonging and wanting to go to college and things like that. In other cases, it means, you know, leaving the gang or, you know, leaving a situation of extreme poverty. But, you know, there are options out there. You know, there are scholarships and, you know, people need to organize to demand, you know, the benefits that we're not getting from the government that we should get. You know, a lot of people are seeing sicko and how, you know, our healthcare system is in this total disgrace. And, you know, we're a very demoralized country right now because we lack all these benefits and we lack all these services that we're entitled to as human beings. And I think that people need to organize to demand those things from the system, as opposed to just basically begging for benefits and services from the military, or just basically conforming to living without that. So I would encourage people to either look for the resources or to organize and you know, demand a profound social change, which is due these
so
days.
We're just speaking to Camilo Mejia, who's the author of Road from Aramadi. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Damon, for having me. And again, apologize to your listeners for last week and to your staff and your producers. You know, they did an incredible job, and I just totally had this, you know, blank in my
brain. No problem at all. No problem.
I apologize, and I want to thank you for your program, too.
All right. Thank you. So that ends today's show from Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Damon Azali Rojas. And I want to thank our guests, Rodrigo Vasquez, a.k.a. Froggy, and Noe Orgaz from the Youth Justice Coalition, Rachel Lopez, and Camilo Mejia. Today we heard music from Jimi Hendrix, Funky 4 Plus 1, Mestre Amen, and this is Oshunlade. We'd like to thank our producer, Christine Blasdell, production assistant, Lisa Adler, Dehan Song, as well as our engineer, Maggie LaPique. We'll see you next week on Voices in the Frontline. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman.